From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. The French chef. Who comes to mind? Jacques Pepin, Daniel Boulud, Eric Ripert? All are classically trained, all work in the U.S., creating a personal expression that combines their childhoods, their training, and their years in America, plus, of course, travel eating. Chef Ludo Lefebvre moved to L.A. from France 21 years ago. Now, his restaurants here include Trois Mecs, Petit Trois, and Trois Familia. Ludo's on the new season of The Mind of a Chef on PBS. His business partners are John Shook and Vinnie Dotolo. Why did you decide to team up with them?
Why I decided to partner with John and Vinnie? Because first of all, we did a lot of work together before, and we become friends. I respect them so much. Like, they're a great cook. They know what they're doing. They're very successful. And John and Vinnie always tell me, why, Ludo, you don't have a restaurant? Why you don't have a restaurant? A chef like you should have a restaurant. I say, I know. I'm looking to find an investor, find a location, all these things, blah, 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 blah. And they always tell me, you know, if you need help, let us know. We'll help you and we'll support you and we'll be your partner. You know, I know how to cook, but never have my own business before. And they are successful guys. So why not to partner with successful people and people I like? They're like my two brothers, definitely. And, you know, they help me a lot, you know, to put my business together, to raise the money with me. They're great guys. You know, I'm successful because of them, definitely. They support me 110%. You know, and they're American. I like that. Because sometimes I'm too French. So I'm so happy to have also American partner. Especially John and Vinnie. They're great cook, don't take themselves too seriously, but they care so much. So I really love their philosophy of cooking and restaurant business.
In the new season of Mind of a Chef, we see you eating with them. They really love making fun of you.
I know.
And your Frenchness.
All the time. They make joke about me one day because I show up in the meeting with a white Levi's 501. What's wrong with that? I mean, in France, we put white Levi's jean. It's nothing wrong with that.
But, you know, I think this says something about how your cooking has evolved. Because you came here when you were a pretty young man.
24.
And
you know, I was a kid, baby.
You were a baby, and you were working for Joie Ferry at L'Orangerie, and the most French of all French restaurants in L.A. We've gotten to see you evolve. When did you first become aware that just being in L.A. and living in L.A. and being out and experiencing things was starting to have an effect on how you viewed your food?
Like you say, you know, when I moved here in 96, I was so French. I was just so French. You know, heaven, so French. But living in L.A. with American people from L.A., from America, I learned a lot about respect, discipline, not complaining. And L.A., I was in shock about all the different flavors in L.A. about the food. You need to understand, I moved from France working all my life in three Michelin restaurants where you just cook French food, discipline the kitchen, get abused. And when I moved here, it was just a different style of lifestyle here. The food was so different for me. It was like an explosion of flavor, you know. So more I'm getting old, you know, the LA, the lifestyle here really influenced me a lot in my cooking.
Bastide was the place that you really sort of opened up yourself.
L'Orangerie was a very classic French restaurant. For almost seven years, I cooked classic French. I left L'Orangerie because I was starting to be a little older and want to cook my own food. So, you know, young chef, you know, we do cook our own food.
So what was your own food at that point?
I didn't know that much was my own food. That's the problem. You know, I start to play at L'Orangerie doing like, I remember one day, like when Mr. Ferry's owner got so mad with me, I did a special and it was like in 2001, it was like a warm asparagus salad with foie gras ice cream. And that's where I was start to change in my head, you know, like I was 31. I want to do something different a little bit. That's what I start to play with different techniques. It was a little time of a start of El Bulli, you know, the new molecular cuisine. I was looking at that, reading book. So I want to play with this new thing. I was excited about that. I want to try that. And then I went to Bastide. I left L'Orangerie and I went to Bastide. And Mr. Picta at Bastide let me do what I want. You know, I was doing a lot of ice cream, hot and cold. I mean, a lot of different combination. My sheer foie gras with pina colada. It was a lot of craziness over there. You know, he was a young kid, a young chef with a good French technique. But also, I was cooking also a different kind of food, you know, like I want to explore different techniques. You know, I was tired to cook French food.
You say that in Mind of a Chef that when you were young, you cooked for yourself, but the job of the chef is to cook for people.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I still believe that. I did so many mistakes when I was young, you know, as a chef. Like my first mistake was not tasting enough my food. And, you know, you have an ego. I'm not afraid to say when I was young, I have an ego. At least he helped me to push myself to be creative. But I realized after, you know, cooking, I realized that when I did my pop-up restaurant, when I was on my own, it's really to give joy to people and to cook for people, not just for me, for myself. You know, now at Trois Mecs, you know, at Trois Mecs, I cook for myself a little bit, but not that much. I don't push too much the envelope. I don't want to say it's safe, but it's still good ingredients, good technique, and not too crazy, like I was doing before.
You know what's interesting to me about your food is there's a lot of really good, carefully considered, high-end, expensive food out there. But for me, very little of it is craveable. Your food is something where you eat it and you're just like, really? I have to wait like 2 months and call a phone line to get in so I can have these potatoes again. Can't I just go to a takeout window and get those potatoes? I mean, that's something that I think is really interesting, that your food is so layered and interesting. There's something about it that's very, very approachable.
It was very important for me, even when I opened Trois Mecs, to be accessible. You know, when I did Ludobite for 4 years, it really opened my mind about what was to be a chef.
Did the success of Ludobites, which, I mean, now we use the word pop-up all the time, but I mean, that was it. That was like the first real successful pop-up. Did how willing people were to go along on that ride with you make it harder for you to make culinary choices or easier?
I knew at that time at Ludobite, I was just cooking for people. And I was not thinking too much. Like I was cooking a lot with instant. Like it was the night before, what am I going to do tomorrow? Boom. Still now at 45 years old, sometimes I think too much about cooking. I should let it go. Like don't think too much. You know what I mean? Like sometimes it takes me 2 weeks to put a dish together. And at Ludobite, it was just in one night.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Whatever you're doing, I think it's working.
You know, but
one of my favorite scenes in City of Gold is that moment where the director zeroes in on your face when you realize that Jonathan Gold has just walked in the restaurant. And in this season's Mind of a Chef, you actually sit down with him in a strip mall restaurant. What was that like for you?
You know, I know Jonathan for a long time now, you know, for a long time. The first time I cooked for him, I think he was at L'Orangerie, perhaps. Jonathan is somebody I respect a lot. He always supports me for a long time. I'm successful because of him, definitely. You know, a critic can make you, like, the king can make you...
Close your restaurant.
I mean, no, I won't say that. Like this. Jonathan, it's a very responsible food critic. I like him. And, when I saw him on these movies, you know, came to the restaurant, I was just stressed. I'm always stressed, you know, to cook for Jonathan. You know, he knows a lot about food. He knows what he's talking about, you know, and he always supports me, so I don't want to disappoint him. It's like a big dad, you know, Jonathan, you know.
Where did you go eat?
He took me in Glendale, I don't know where, I don't remember the name of the restaurant. It was an Indonesian restaurant. I eat amazing fried chicken over there. Amazing.
Oh, I love that he took you to eat fried chicken.
Yeah. And after we went also to Koreatown. But, you know, just to be Jonathan, like a day, you know, I learned so much. And he teach me also so much about the culture of Los Angeles. I wish as a chef I can spend more time with him. I learned a lot that day with him.
It's no secret that I really love Petit Trois. For me, it's like going to the spa.
Because a lot of butter, a lot of spice, a lot of cream.
For me, it's just like the perfect experience. I love how tiny it is, how crowded it is. The food is just extraordinary. Every time I go, I find myself ordering vegetables more and more and more. Could you describe something that's on the menu now? That's a vegetable dish?
So now we have a crudités plate with a lot of raw roots vegetable from the market now. And actually, I don't do aioli. Actually, I do something like my partner Vinny and Johnny show me. They teach me how to do some good ranch sauce. So that's when the French and the American cook together. But that's what I like about my partner, because they teach me about America also, what they like. And I put that in my food also. So I take this crudité plate and I just use a ranch sauce, like their secret sauce, you know. So we have this crudité salad with a ranch sauce and a fennel pollen. We have also a green bean salad with feta and strawberry. In France, we don't eat that much vegetable in the bistro, it's true. But, you know, we have a beautiful farmer's market here, so I want to use it. But, you know, even the funny thing is I put vegetable on my menu at Petit Trois. I don't sell a lot of vegetables. People go over there for the onion soup. They go for the steak frites. They go for the fried chicken with brioche. I mean, people eat like so heavy and they love it.
Well, I made myself.
It's crazy.
I made myself start to order the vegetables because, you know, I thought to myself, these have to be delicious. And then as I have worked through the menu and go with friends and we'll like share dishes, it's hard sometimes to not order the burger and to...
That's good, huh? The burger is good. Oh. Trust me.
I know. It's
I love burger.
Yes, it's insane.
It's my favorite sandwich. I remember when I opened Petit Trois, I was very like, Vinny said, oh, Ludo, you need to put a burger. I don't want to put a burger, Vinny. It's a French restaurant. I don't want to give the wrong message to people. And I went to Chicago and eat Au Cheval. Oh, oh my God. Love the burger over there. And when I come back, I say, I want a burger like this on my menu. I twist it a little bit, not like them, but I love a good burger.
One of the richest things I've ever eaten in my life.
The sauce, it's a Bordelaise emulsion with foie gras, you know. We don't emulsion with butter, but with foie gras, the sauce. That's the emulsion.
Yeah,
you know?
I couldn't.
You know, it's very classic.
I should have taken half of it home, but it's like you can't stop. Yeah. Given that you made this restaurant, Petit Trois, like, for me, it's like the perfect restaurant. Now you're going to open in the Valley. People in the Valley are so happy. Every time I see people in the Valley, they always ask me, why don't chefs come here and open restaurants? So now you're doing this, but it's not going to be the same.
I mean, the menu, Petit Trois in the Valley, is going to be more like a little brasserie. Okay, the menu is going to be the same, but bigger. Okay, I'm going to have props open for breakfast and lunch, of course. Mm-hmm. A lot of breakfast. And to go, I'm going to focus also on to go in the Valley, like whole roasted chicken with potato. I mean, a lot of things like this. More dishes, you know, more dishes, definitely. Because Petit Trois now on Highland and Melrose is very small. We have a small kitchen. So the menu is like 12 Adam. That's it. So the Valley, I want to have like 20 or 25.
I wish you would open for breakfast on Highland. I'm sorry.
I know, but the kitchen is too small.
I know.
But you know,
just for coffee and croissant.
And croissant, waffles, you know.
Oh, that would be good. You know, waffles and chicken.
Yeah. But no, the Valley, I'm very excited. You know, I mean, it's going to be like a big restaurant for me. It's going to be like 70 seats.
You know, that's huge.
So we're going to have a booth, you know, a booth, you know, too, and still the same bar, but still not that big. You know, it's still be very intimate, you know, not like a big restaurant, 150 seats. It's still just 60 seats and 10 seats at the bar, you know. So it's still very, very intimate. Because, you know, what I like about Petit Trois now, it's very intimate. Like, it's 22 seats. You know everybody. You meet people. It's a little restaurant in the corner, neighborhood people. I know everybody, your neighbor now. I just love this ambiance. You know, it's very French, like a little corner arrondissement restaurant. Like people from Hancock Park just walk to see me, you know, at Petit Trois. It's like a bar with food.
Thank you so much for coming.
Merci, Evan. Merci again.
That's Ludo Lefebvre. He's working on opening a second location of Petit Trois in Sherman Oaks, and he's just received a James Beard nomination for Best Chef. Now let's take a trip to New Orleans. On a pretty stretch of Magazine Street, Chef Alon Shaya is going back to his roots. Born in Tel Aviv, but raised in Philadelphia, he presents modern versions of Israeli cuisine, like duck matzo ball soup and avocado toast with white fish. This in a city known for jambalaya, gumbo, beignet, and sazerac. Last spring, his restaurant Shaya nabbed a James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant. You hit your stride in New Orleans with Italian food, moving to Italy after Katrina, and then you returned home to the city to helm Domenica and its spinoff, Pizza Domenica. Was there always an eventual plan to open an Israeli concept?
No, there wasn't. Domenica, I opened in 2009. My goal was to, you know, become the next Mario Batali and be all things Italian food. And it wasn't until I took a trip to Israel in 2011, kind of like a light went off in my head, and I realized that I've been shunning this important part of my culinary past for so many years and really needed to embrace it. And I didn't realize even then that I was going to open an Israeli restaurant, but I just started sneaking all this Israeli food onto the menu at Domenica. And I would make things like hummus and just call it chechi puree, where I would do shakshuka, but with like roasted goat shoulder and chanterelle mushrooms and roasted peppers. And everybody was really enjoying the items that I was making, and I really, as I was making them, felt more and more connected with who I really was, just personally and culinarily. And it wasn't until 2014 that I made the decision to actually open an Israeli restaurant.
It's so fascinating to me because so many Jews in the United States are of Eastern European background, and I think about, you know, offering gefilte fish or kasha varnishkas in my Italian restaurant and imagine that I would have been booed down. But it's fascinating to watch this trend of Israeli food finding its way into restaurants in our city like Zahav in Philadelphia and Jessica Coslow and the Sarahs of Mad Capra and Jen Lewis, all opening restaurants in L.A. with an Israeli bent. Do you feel that it's really a trend to modernize some of these traditional dishes?
I hope it's not a trend, because if it's a trend, that means it's going to go away at some point. I think that it's really something that's going to be here to stay, the way that Chinese food or pizza has kind of caught on in America. I think that people are getting the word more and more about what countries make up the Israeli culture and cuisine, you know, and it stems so far away from just Israel, of course, because it's influenced by Morocco and by Syria and Palestine and Yemen and Bulgaria and all these cultures that are living in Israel and cooking these foods have brought that tradition with them to Israel, and my goal is to really just kind of celebrate that diversity of culture and tradition through food. I think that people in America are now kind of understanding that more and realize that there's all these great vegetable dishes and spices and healthy cooking and a lot of olive oil. Everybody was really ripe for it.
How did you decide what dishes in the Jewish culinary canon deserved updating? And I'm particularly interested in that all of this for you is happening in a place where so much of the cuisine is seafood and pork-based.
Definitely. Crab and andouille sausage reign supreme in Louisiana. I love to eat and cook those things all the time. At Shaya, we really wanted to celebrate the tradition of what was being cooked. And so while we've had dishes on the menu with shrimp or with scallops, like not everything is actually kosher ingredient. We're not a kosher restaurant. You know, there's not an immediate need to like put pork on the menu or throw crab on top of everything. Like, we have to really just kind of celebrate the cuisine that we've chosen to represent at the restaurant. And there's so much to play with. We've never even thought about getting bored with it. And it's really important for us that we, of course, celebrate our resources that we have here in Louisiana, which there are so many. And so we use red snapper, and we get that from the Gulf of Mexico, and we use broccoli that we get from a farm 20 minutes away from the restaurant, and lamb that our friend Charlie raises for us, and chickens from a farm called D&M Farms. So we have so many great resources here that we tap into, and we're able to cook the dishes that are traditional without having to mess around with them too much.
Could you talk a little bit about Jerusalem Mixed Grill? Describe what it is and how you went about making the version that you offer?
Yeah. So a Jerusalem mixed grill is a very popular street food. It's a sandwich that's eaten throughout Israel. And it really is comprised of several different cuts of meat. And it's typically all of like the organs or offal of chicken, because you have all this chicken shawarma all over Israel, or you have lamb shawarma all over Israel, or beef. And what they would start doing at the market with all the offal would be take all that and kind of just saute it up and griddle it on a flat top grill with some onions, and then shove that into pita and drizzle some tahini on top with some spicy peppers. And that kind of was like the working man's lunch. It was cheaper than all the other sandwiches. It was something that a lot of soldiers who were always traveling on a very tight budget were able to order, and it would fill them up and have a ton of protein. So it was kind of like a win-win situation for everybody. And I fell in love with Jerusalem mixed grills while I was in Israel, particularly because I always loved things like chicken hearts and chicken livers, and they even traditionally will put chicken spleens in there as well. What we decided to do when we were opening Shai and we were testing all the recipes was like, you know, this is such a great sandwich. Like, we also buy our chickens whole and it comes with all the organs, and like, how do we make use out of all this stuff and show people what this sandwich is? You know, there's no easy way to say, like, here's a sandwich full of like chicken hearts and livers and spleens. You have to either be into it or you're not into it. In Louisiana, people are into all kinds of stuff. We also put veal sweetbreads in there that we like because it adds a really nice creaminess to the whole texture of the filling. And so we'll take pita bread, we bake it in our wood-burning oven, and we slather it with a little bit of hummus. And then we take our veal sweetbreads and chicken livers and chicken hearts and spleens, and we saute them on a really hot saute pan with a little bit of skoog, which is like a spicy Yemenite pepper sauce. It's green peppers with a little bit of allspice and vinegar. And so we spoon a little bit of that skoog in, and we saute all that up together and put it into the pita bread. And then we drizzle a little bit of tahini and sprinkle a little bit of orange zest on top of the whole thing, which really adds a bright citrus flavor and cuts through a lot of that richness, and some chopped fresh parsley and cilantro.
Wow, that sounds so good. Is this a dish that could be made at home, or do you think people would be too afraid of the aroma or the heat necessary to really sear all those innards up?
It can definitely be made at home. When you buy whole chickens, or you pull out that little bag of organs from the chicken, you know, separate out the livers and the hearts. And if the spleens are in there, that's great. They look like little kidney beans, kind of. You know, take those, rinse them off, season them with some salt, put a pan on your stovetop, and if you have a hood venting system, turn it on high, or if not, be ready for your house to smoke up a little bit. Open some windows, but you need to get a pan really hot with some good olive oil, and then throw in all those organs, a little bit of your favorite hot sauce on top, like a green Tabasco could also work really, really well, and maybe some sliced onions if you want that. That's pretty much it. That can then go on to any kind of bread. And if you make a little bit of fresh prepared tahini and drizzle that over, you got yourself a really good sandwich.
I'm going to be obsessed with this until I make it.
You're going to love it. Trust me. It's so good. And it's such a great way to use all the parts of the chicken and make sure that we're, you know, respecting everything that the animal has given its life for.
How important was it to you to have a wood-burning oven where you could make the pita fresh constantly throughout the day?
That was one of the things that I knew when I was going to open Shia that was going to be the most important parts of the restaurant, because our wood oven is in the dining room. It serves as kind of like an anchor in the dining room, and any table can see it from where they're sitting. At all times of the day, there's someone there pulling hot, toasty pita bread out of this oven. and it fills the dining room up with this great aroma of baked bread. And when people kind of crack into the pita bread and they see the steam rising out, they know that they're in for something that's really special and that it may not be the same pita bread that they were used to, you know, growing up that they bought from the grocery store. And I think it just kind of sets the tone for the dining experience in a way that I wanted people to feel comfortable and familiar with our menu and our food. I think everybody really has a good understanding of what pita bread is. And if that's the first thing that you're getting, then it kind of puts you at ease, especially if it's a really good one, full of steam and freshly baked. It allows you to kind of sit back and say, okay, I'm ready for what's coming next, and not feel intimidated that you might not know what Israeli food is or have had Israeli food before. When you really break it down, all the ingredients are very familiar and very approachable, like our hummus, our falafel, like kebabs. You know, you can call all these things different names. You can call the kebabs meatballs, and you can call a fattoush salad a green salad. And it doesn't sound as intimidating at that point for people that might not be familiar with the cuisine.
That's Alon Shaya. His restaurant in New Orleans is eponymous, Shaya. Congrats to the restaurant's chef de cuisine, Zachary Engel, who just received a Beard nomination for Rising Star Chef of the Year. Up next, we find out what's in season at the market. So stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. It is time for the Market Report, so let's find out what Laura Avery's shopping for this week in Santa Monica.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're really celebrating California heritage grains today and every day at the farmers market. There's a huge grains revival going on in California. Larry Kandarian is a farmer who has been coming to the Wednesday market now for a couple of months. Larry, we're standing in the middle of your booth. Just tell us how many different kinds of grains and legumes you grow.
Well, grains, we probably have about 15 that have gluten and several that don't. We have alternate grains, but another five or six. And then the legumes, beans, peas, favas, lentils, we're probably another 10 or 12. So there's probably 40 things here. And then we do our herbs and spices. We're up to about 70.
Where do you grow all this?
I grow in Los Osos on my farm.
Okay, and is that an ideal climate for growing all these varied kinds of grains and legumes?
Yeah, for almost everything. And talking to Stephen Jones from the bread lab in the state of Washington, he says the ideal climate for grains is cool and moist, and Los Osos is exactly that, cool and moist. And where I'm growing, people look at me and say, you can't grow grains there, it's not warm enough. It doesn't have to be, according to him. And when I go back, my next-door neighbor's 94, and the entire Los Osos Valley was grain before the World War II, and they used to take them to a processing plant just down the street from me, about a mile away, and winnow them and clean them and put them in sacks that weighed 200 pounds when men were men, and hoist them by the ears and put them on a truck. Yeah.
So, Larry, you talked about cool and moist. Now, we've had 5 years of drought, and now we have, like, you know, epical rains. How is that working for your crops growing?
We have some carryover crops. Right now we have black barley that is headed, and we're ready to harvest it, but we need a window of warm weather. Also, camu and turkey red wheat, and I think some einkorn that we planted late, because our climate is such that we can get two crops of grain in a year off the same acreage. Not the exact same field, but we move it around because it's kaleidoscopic what we do. We keep changing crops. So we can plant all the way into August and harvest in October, November, where typically you plant in October, November, and harvest in May or June. So we can do twice.
What is the most popular grain that you sell?
I think it's Ethiopian blue tinge farro, which is the very most sustainable one, and it's 9,500 years old and started in the Fertile Crescent. by the Tigris and the Euphrates and moved over to Ethiopia, and it's easily thrashed, and it has a purple color, so it has a lot of anthocyanins, antioxidants. And that one, or else my Tibetan black barley, which is 8,000 years old. Those two, and teff is really gaining popularity. It's crazy. We have some teff brownies here that you just tasted a while ago, I think, and they're delicious. Yeah.
How did the seeds come to you?
I started from the different seed repositories in the United States, which collects from all over the world. And it's a really peaceful story, because even warring countries will share their seeds with us. So it's wonderful. We have stuff from Afghanistan. We have from Pakistan. So it's interesting. So we start with just a very few seeds. And I've been in the seed business since Christ was a pup. And so I know how to blow it up and make it better and get more seed. And so that's what I do.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
That was Larry Kandarian, and he grows many, many kinds of grains and legumes and herbs up in Los Osos, and he's bringing us delicious varieties of things to taste and experiment with. Robin Cota is a third-generation rice farmer, and she comes to the Wednesday market once a month, and today's the day, Robin. You're here with your Cota Farms Heritage Heirloom Rice. Can you explain to us what variety of rice that is?
Well, my family's been farming rice in California since the late 1910s, so I'm backtracking here, folks. Third generation, I would like to say we're great growing rice and slow procreation. So anyway, during those nearly 100 years of growing rice now in California, in the 1950s, we had our own seed program, and over the course of about 10 years, we crossbred a Japanese short grain with other varieties to get a grain that would be unique and proprietary and that would thrive in our microclimate and soil types. And so we are the southernmost located rice farm in California, essentially the same latitude as Gilroy, but inland off the I-5. So that is not your typical historical area for growing rice in California. The ground there is very poor. It's adobe. It's alkaline. So to grow rice there, we needed to customize something. So from that period in the 50s, we came up with a type of rice that did well there. This rice is literally the last type of Japanese rice to be harvested in California. It's just a total labor of love. It's extremely laborious. It takes a 3-year growing cycle. We actually maintain our own nurseries. We plant the rice, we farm the rice, we dry it. We also process it and mill it, and we package all on site. So we're totally hands-on from beginning to end.
So during the last 100 years when your grandfather started this in 1910, were your relatives actually in the internment camps?
Oh, yeah, yeah, because they were farming here on the West Coast. My grandfather immigrated to California in 1908, and by the outbreak of World War II through the 1940s, he was known as the Rice King in California because he was essentially farming and owned about 10,000 acres of farmland. He had his own mill. He was processing his own product. He was packaging his own products. So he was very successful. And the downside of that was that there was a lot of resentment. And essentially, after the internment, they came back and the farm had been sold off. There was about 1,000 acres of land left. The farm, the mill, their homes, all of the equipment had been sold off. And he had to start up from ground zero again. But that man literally set down root a quarter mile away from where his original headquarters was and started up again. So that is now still my brothers and our current site.
Was there any question that you were going to continue the tradition?
No, I wasn't expected initially to be involved in the farming, but it's sort of hard to escape when that's what you did in your summers. We like worked on the farm. I have a Master's of Fine Arts from the School of the Arts of Chicago. But then my mom was constantly like, why aren't you working here? You should be like paying more like respect to your elders. You know, we went through all this, went through the tournament, we lost so much, and you're not being appreciative. So what do you do?
All right. Well, we love having you, Robin. Thanks a lot. That was Robin Cota. She is the granddaughter of the founder of Cota Farms and grows these lovely, delicious heirloom rices that everyone should try. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Drinks as big as your head. Doesn't that sound good? Giant totems, shipwreck, and maritime paraphernalia. That's right. We're talking tiki next. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. When San Francisco's Tiki Paradise Smuggler's Cove opened in 2009, its website didn't offer an address. Instead, there was a series of puzzles and games that led to the proverbial X marking the spot on a pirate map. A gauntlet was thrown down for thirsty patrons of the Tiki Renaissance. So where did this fascination with Tiki begin? We called the founder and owner of the bar, Martin Cait. He has a new book on Tiki culture that's named after the bar. I'm always curious about how people's obsessions start. So for you, how did this particular obsession with Tiki begin?
Well, it began really in earnest in 1994. I was living and working in Washington, D.C., and I was working at this embassy, and I had a coworker, and he said, it was his birthday, and he said, let's go out for drinks. I said, where do you want to go? He said, let's go to Trader Vic's. I said, I don't know. What's a Trader Vic's? And he said, oh, you're going to love it. They got drinks as big as your head. It's great. I said, all right. So we tootled down there. And it was this experience. It's kind of, you have to put yourself in the mindset of somebody sort of impressionable and young in the middle of a cold winter in Washington, D.C., and going to the Hilton there. And it's, you know, kind of a very austere gray marble edifice and a cold, drizzly night. And you go downstairs and you go into the basement. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's this one doorway. And it looks like a portal to another world. There's flickering torches and these large idols and this thatched roof. And it just says Trader Vic's. And you go inside and all of a sudden it's this transformative experience where you walk in and everything, suddenly it smells of gardenias, there's soft music playing, there's all these puffer fish and beautiful artwork and gorgeous materials everywhere. And it was the beginning of this fascination. It was the beginning of this obsession with what was this crazy thing that happened that so many Americans were so entranced by for decades, this notion of this escape to this imaginary South Pacific. That was really what got me. And yes, and the drinks were huge, and the rum didn't hurt either.
Tiki's roots are so odd because it is sort of this fantasy that was like a mashup that came about through many different forces. Could you talk a bit about the original burgeoning of Tiki?
Well, we trace it back to one man, which is Don Beach, a.k.a. Don the Beachcomber. He opened his first restaurant in Hollywood in 1933, just at the very end of Prohibition. And he had traveled throughout the South Pacific and explored lots of different people and places. And he came back with all kinds of flotsam and jetsam and various ephemera from his journeys. And he hung it all up and he made this sort of imaginary escape, this kind of rough-hewn sort of beach shack that didn't really exist in any specific place. It celebrated this long-standing wish amongst Americans, which really started at the end of the 19th century with adventure novels, Robert Louis Stevenson, continued into the 1920s as we fell in love with the music of Hawaii and the romance and the beauty of Hawaii and hapa-haole music and things. We had this desire to pursue a simpler life and just to kind of put your toes in the sand and listen to the, you know, the palm trees at dusk and have a cocktail. And this particularly appealing in the height of the Depression to go somewhere else. This is at a time when Americans weren't traveling and we didn't have the internet or color TV. And so your notions of what the South Pacific were like were largely informed by people, novelists and things. You had an opportunity to just walk down the street and go to this place that looked like something, this kind of wild bamboo and thatched fever dream that just took you out of your misery, took you out of your day-to-day life and just left you in this wonderful sort of cocooning oasis. And as America, especially in the 1950s, as we came out of the Depression and we became very successful, you know, more and more, there was an even more desire to get away because, of course, now you were working even harder. And it was the rise of, you know, the rise of the commuter and the suburbs and everything else. And you were working harder and harder. And now you really did want that place more than ever, the place to loosen your tie and take your hat off and just let a cool rum drink go down your throat. Now, what's weird, then this is the part that's kind of unusual, is that it's aesthetically and visually inspired by the South Pacific, but from a cocktail standpoint, it's inspired by the Caribbean. So the drinks themselves have their roots in planter's punches and in simple Caribbean cocktails because they have their roots in rum. Rum was Don Beach's inspiration. So, you know, the South Pacific doesn't have a rum tradition. So he kind of brings together the beverages of the Caribbean and the aesthetic or an, sort of an imagined aesthetic from the South Pacific.
the latest tiki revival is going so strong, and the menu at your place, Smuggler's Cove, acts something like a manifesto paying homage to tiki's sort of go-to spirit of rum. And you divide the cocktail menu into historic and regional categories. Rum's famously the most diverse of spirits. How do you go about choosing the right rum for a cocktail when you have hundreds of options?
Well, what we did was this was my second project, and the idea was I thought, well, you know, tiki, and I love tiki, and I love exotic cocktails that came out of the tiki bar movement. But that's 40 years of rum's three-century story. So our idea was, let's go back, let's take a look at all of historically how rum has played a part in drinks and played a part in the history of the development of the Western world. So we have colonial tavern drinks, pirate drinks, Royal Navy drinks, Caribbean classics, regional drinks from the Caribbean, you know, Jamaican drinks. How do Jamaicans drink Jamaican rum in Jamaica? And, you know, modern cocktails to show that, you know, rum is extraordinarily diverse and it can have a tremendous and wide range of cocktail applications. So we've got a lot of modern and contemporary drinks as well. So right now for our drink menu, which is 105 cocktails, it takes about 26 or 27 different rums, and those rums often in combination to execute the menu in a way that we're happy with. And to be honest, it's always evolving. It's production method and history first over all other considerations.
Tiki drinks tend to have a bad rap in that people think they're filled with sugar. They think rum itself is filled with sugar and that you're guaranteed to have a terrible hangover from them. I've always found them to be when they're made well, incredibly well-balanced and not so sugary. Could you talk about that misconception?
Sure. So as tiki bars start to fade and as all these wonderfully, beautifully balanced drinks start to fall out of favor, either because the recipes are lost, because of the rise of instant garbage powdered sour mixes and synthetic coconut snow and all this stuff that starts to appear that, you know, becomes faster and easier, and it's harder, getting increasingly hard to find a bartender willing to make you a 13-ingredient drink. So pretty soon, they just become these sort of slushy nightmares. People start to think, well, yeah, sure, a tiki drink, that's the thing they hand you when you step off the plane in Honolulu. And everything was lost. I mean, these drinks fell so far and so hard. So not only are we trying to make these drinks great, but we're also trying to kind of restore the reputation simultaneously. So you're absolutely right in saying they're not overly sweetened. They're beautiful and in good balance. And I think it's important to touch on the notion of rum, you know, as being a sweet product, because rum is a distilled spirit just like anything else, and sugar does not travel through distillation. Remember that all spirits are made from sugar in some capacity, whether it's grapes in brandies or whether you're getting sugars out of the grains in a vodka. I mean, that's what yeast feeds on. Everything comes from a sugar of a kind, but sugar doesn't travel through the distillation process. So rum has exactly as much sugar in it when it's made and bottled as vodka does. Now, having said that, it's no mystery that there are rum producers out there who do add sugar post-distillation to their products. Ideally, if you're adding the sugar, you're being transparent about the process, you are being honest and with your consumers, and you're explaining that there's a reason why.
I have to ask you, what do you say to people who worry that tiki exoticizes Polynesian culture?
Well, it's a fair question, and it does come up now and again. Tiki was born at a time when Americans really enjoyed cultural adventures in dining and drinking, and they enjoyed a sense of artifice and a sense of adventure and exploration, and that the whole experience was a kind of a mild sort of ethnographic lesson in another culture. Like, this is Swiss themed restaurants. Oh, apparently they make cuckoo clocks. Or this is the South Pacific, and look at this. I'm learning about all of these different tikis from all of these different cultures, or all of this tiki was carved in the Marquesas Islands. You didn't come away with a PhD in cultural anthropology from going to a tiki bar, but you took a little bit of journey, and hopefully it opened your eyes a little bit to the idea that there were all these islands and all these different cultures. So one of the things we're particularly sensitive about is the notion of this word kitsch. And those of us who do tiki and are really passionate about it recognize that it's not kitsch, it's art, and that the arts are produced by really skilled carvers, tapa cloth makers, painters, musicians, all of these arts come together to give you this magical experience. And are there certain things that can be left behind that we would see, you know, some racially tinged menu illustrations, perhaps? You can leave all that stuff behind. It's obviously out of date and offensive, and it doesn't do anything to dissuade or dispel the magic of tiki. You know, for us, like I say, we really do think it's beautiful work, and if our guests come in and think it's all a bit of a laugh, well, that's great. They're smiling. I'm happy. But, you know, we give you a better experience when we show you real craftsmanship rather than plastic party supply garbage.
One of my favorite quotes in the book is when you talk about how embracing the tiki lifestyle can be the god of, you actually call tiki the god of doomed relationships.
Yes.
Why is that? People just fall too deep down the rabbit hole?
Being part of this community for about 20 years now has been, it's just, there's something about it. It's a very compelling aesthetic. And as you start to build your home paradise, as you start to lash the bamboo to the walls and put the palm cape up and create this imaginary paradise, yeah, it can get a little involving. You know, there's sort of no other drink fad or cocktail thing. And it's so encompassing that when you become obsessed with, it's not like becoming obsessed with rye whiskey or something where you might collect a bunch of rye whiskey. This is becoming obsessed with all these rums and all this artwork and all this decor. And I basically, the point of this little passage in the book is your partner better be on board too, because I've seen a lot of relationships hit the rocks from this, because it does tend to be, you know, not just from the sort of the financial standpoint and the art and the decor, but of course there's also all the tiki gatherings. We getting together at tiki conventions and meeting for food and drink and things like that. So, I mean, you kind of like crab rangoon and rum drinks.
That's Martin Kate. His new book is called Smuggler's Cove, Exotic Cocktails, Rum, and the Cult of Tiki. We have a recipe for a great drink for you, a cocktail that was created during World War II, named after the word victory. In Morse code, it's called Three Dots and a Dash. You can find it on the Good Food blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we get schooled on food fraud. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
When you don't know what the good stuff tastes like and then you have it, you know, your eyes light up. It's like an epiphany and you'll never be fooled again. And I think that's true about a lot of these real foods in my book is once you taste the good stuff, it's a lot harder to be fooled.
That's Larry Olmsted. From extra virgin olive oil to Parmesan cheese, Olmsted breaks down scams at the supermarket in his sometimes alarming new book, Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating and What You Can Do About It. What is fake food as you define it?
Well, I'd broadly define it as when you get something other than what you think you're paying for, whether at retail or restaurant. And that's sort of a sliding scale. There are outright counterfeits that are illegal, and there are lots of frauds, or what I consider frauds, that are legal but misleading to the consumer.
Let's start with the ones that are illegal.
And probably, you know, the biggest example of that would be in seafood, where there's something called species substitution, where you order a particular kind of fish and you get a different kind of fish, completely a different species that's always less expensive and usually less desirable. The prime example would be red snapper, which is the most commonly substituted fish in the United States. It's an expensive white fish that's always wild caught. And so you order red snapper and you get something like farmed imported tilapia.
Oh, that's just so sad. Now, is the deception being perpetrated by the distributor to the restaurant or by the restaurant to the diner?
For most of the history of seafood fraud, and it's something that's gotten a lot of attention, the assumption has been that it happens somewhere further up the supply chain, the importer, the distributor, the wholesaler, because seafood has a particularly opaque and convoluted supply chain, and more than 90% of the seafood we consume in this country is imported. But the FDA just sort of cracked down its inspections and analysis and DNA testing, and their first reports have sort of surprised the industry show that only about 15% of the seafood is mislabeled when it's reaching the last point of sale, which is either a restaurant or retailer. But more than a third of the seafood in this country is mislabeled. So the new thought is that most of it is being done by the restaurants and retailers.
That's even sadder. So let's talk about regulation or oversight. Are there people who go out to restaurants that are part of the FDA or the USDA and do inspections?
Well, no, because restaurants are not under the same labeling laws that apply to retail. So the USDA and the FDA's job is not to monitor the accuracy of restaurant claims. That's done at the state level, and it varies from state to state. In Florida, where they've had a lot of kind of egregious seafood fraud, the state economic crimes unit of the state police has started cracking down on restaurants. In some states, they don't really do anything about it.
Do you feel that we as consumers have some responsibility in that? Are we so naive as to believe that we could get lobster that cheaply?
I think our responsibility in that regard is that we take foods that we like, that are meant to be celebratory foods, and insist on turning them mainstream. When I was growing up, shrimp was a special occasion food. You went to maybe a nice steakhouse and you had a shrimp cocktail, and that was like a splurge. There was never this idea that shrimp would be something you could get all you could eat popcorn shrimp for $9.99. Shrimp is now the most consumed seafood in the United States. So it went from sort of being a luxury item to being the equivalent of the fast food hamburger. That necessitates a lot of cheap shrimp farming to meet that kind of demand, which is just what we get in Southeast Asia using often banned chemicals, even slave labor.
So let's move to fraud. And of course, when I think about fraud, the first thing I think about is olive oil.
Yeah, olive oil is a tricky one because it has a very long history of fraud. They did a study of academic and research articles over a 30-year period from 1980 to 2010, and it's the single most referenced food in the entire world of food fraud. There's very differing degrees. There has been outright criminal adulteration where cheaper oils are dyed or mixed or, you know, flavored to look like olive oil, which can be very dangerous to consumers, especially if they have allergens and they use peanut oil or seed oils. But more often than not these days, because the testing has gotten a lot better for olive oil, I think the bigger problem is you just get a lower quality olive oil. So it's something that's made from olives but won't pass the legal standards to be labeled extra virgin. And in the studies, the numbers have been getting better. But by getting better, I mean from studies a few years ago where 70% of what we buy at retail fails to closer to 50%. The good news in olive oil is that it's getting easier to buy really good olive oil. But it's just it's an area in particular where the consumer has to be informed. And once they're informed, they can do pretty well for themselves.
Let's talk about Kobe beef. How readily available is it in the U.S.?
There are currently 10 restaurants in the United States that serve real Kobe beef from Japan and hundreds of others that have Kobe beef on their menu that is bogus.
So there's this other word called Wagyu. Could you describe what Wagyu is and how that factors into this conversation?
Sure. Wagyu is a Japanese word meaning Japanese cattle. And traditionally, Wagyu refers to five indigenous Japanese brands of beef. Kobe is Wagyu that's grown in the Kobe region. And there's several other high-end Japanese Wagyus like that that are named for their region, like Hokkaido beef and Sendai beef. So you could theoretically export Wagyu cattle from Japan and raise them someplace else, which they do in the United States and Australia in particularly. But you can't raise Kobe beef somewhere else because it can only come from Kobe. However, the problem in both cases is neither of those terms are protected legally in the United States. So restaurants can call anything they want Kobe beef or Wagyu, whether it's domestic, whether it's from Japan, whether it's from neither of those places, whatever kind of cattle it is. And lots of them do because they know that consumers will pay more for either Wagyu or Kobe. I'm very leery of both those words when I see them on menus.
And once again, if you've ever had a piece of real Kobe beef, first of all, you would never get a 10-ounce steak. It's so rich that even 2 ounces is just unbelievably filling.
Yeah, I mean, it's much fattier than the beef we eat here, and also the kind of fat. It's higher in the monounsaturated fats, which melt at a lower temperature, lower than your body temperature. So the fat in the meat literally melts in your tongue. It's also can only by law, the USDA regulations, be exported to the United States in boneless fashion. So if you ever see a restaurant claiming to serve like a Wagyu porterhouse or T-bone or bone-in rib steak, all of which I've seen, it's just not physically possible because that meat does not exist here.
So cheese. Let's talk about cheese. As a child, I had a great affection for that green can of powdered Parmesan. What should we know about fake Parmesan? Do you think that people really think that green can is actual Parmesan cheese?
I really don't, and I don't really consider that a big problem. You know, there was a lot of press earlier this year because when they tested not just the green can, but all kinds of brands of that pre-grated Parmesan cheese, it had surprisingly high levels of cellulose, which is a plant fiber that they use to prevent it from clumping on the shelves, though a lot of brands had far more than you need to prevent the clumping. You know, cellulose also happens to be cheaper than cheese, so that's why there's so much of it in there. But I don't really view that as nearly as big a problem as the media made it out to be, because if you really care about food or cook or have a sense of taste, you're not going to really rely on that canned grated stuff anyway. To me, the bigger problem is when you walk into the cheese section and there's several wedges that all say Parmesan cheese and are all around the same price, but only one of them is what I consider the real Parmesan, which is Parmigiano Reggiano, which comes from Parma in Italy, which is where Parmesan cheese gets its name from.
Which you pay a premium for.
Well, actually, you do and you don't. This is one of the rare cases in sort of the high-end real food where the substitutes are often as expensive or more expensive. And, you know, the website Serious Eats, which does a lot of product testing, they bought up all these samples of domestic Parmesan to try to find a cheaper alternative to Parmesan Reggiano. And not only did they taste them all and find them all inferior to the Italian version, but several of them were more expensive.
So interesting. Journalist Larry Olmsted's new expose is Real Food, Fake Food, Why You Don't Know What You're Eating, and What You Can Do About It. That is it for this week's show. Thank you for hanging out with us. If you missed any part of it, you can always listen to the show at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, so many thanks to the team. They are
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine,
Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.